It is Friday, August the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, new U.S. sanctions on Russia might not destroy the relationship.
I think you want to keep communications channels open. I think they're a controlled, managed, what they call managed democracy, but they're not. It's not the Soviet Union.
Another devastating quake hitting Indonesia, plus an American group helping out with projects in Vietnam.
Clean water and sanitation, education, the third is child health, pediatric health, and the fourth is construction of what we call Vietnam's social infrastructure.
And also ahead, a little something from the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The United States is imposing new sanctions on Russia following the nerve agent attack on a Russian spy, a former Russian spy, and his daughter that happened in Britain in March. The British government determined the toxin used against Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury was Novichok, that is a military-grade agent developed in then the Soviet Union. Both were hospitalized for weeks and have since recovered from the effects of that attack. A U.S. State Department press statement said the sanctions to take effect on or around August the 22nd are based on Moscow's violation of the 1991 Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act. Shortly after the Novichok attack, the U.S. joined Europe in ordering dozens of Russian diplomats to leave and shuttered the Russian consulate in Seattle, Washington. The decision comes at a time when the Trump administration is seeking ways to improve relations with Moscow. Robert Manning, a senior fellow and security expert at the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the sanctions could be serious.
It involves technology exports. It involves both international institution lending and lending from U.S. banks. There are some potential waivers on some of the technology exports, for example, spare parts for the space station, which we still have with Russia, and that sort of thing. And I think there are some other waiver possibilities, but I think it's pretty extensive, and it's coming at a time when the ruble has hit new lows. The sanctions have driven down their currency. So I think it's going to cause a fair amount of pain.
Will this upend the president's effort to improve relations with Moscow?
That's a complicated relationship. We have two nuclear weapon states. Putin apparently had proposed some ideas for arms control to the president. I would argue that extending New START and perhaps even going to lower levels of nuclear weapons is in both the U.S. and Russian interests. So I don't see any reason why we shouldn't proceed on that. It depends on that front, and it really is sort of a case by case. We have to push them to get a settlement in Ukraine, for example, and Syria is really a huge issue that has fundamentally destabilized Europe with the refugee flow. So if we can get any cooperation from them on that, then I think that's worth pursuing. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Which means?
Which means there are components of the relationship where I think we can move forward, and I think we have to keep the sanctions on. Look, there have to be some standards in the world, and you can't allow governments to go around poisoning people the way that Putin has done on several occasions now. There have to be costs to that.
Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is in Moscow and apparently handed a letter from President Trump to his Russian counterpart. The contents are not exactly clear, but there apparently was an offer of cooperation in various areas like terrorism, legislative dialogue, and resuming cultural exchanges.
I think that there's a case to be made for that. I think you want to keep communications channels open. I think they're a controlled, managed, what they call managed democracy, but they're not. It's not the Soviet Union. I don't see a downside to that. And I think on issues like terrorism, counter-narcotics activity, possibly Afghanistan, North Korea, we need to work with Russia to get results that we want on a number of issues.
Russia's American embassy dismissed what it called the far-fetched accusations that were made in the U.S. decision, insisting it had been presented no facts or evidence and demanded an open and transparent investigation of the crime committed in Salisbury. A Russian lawmaker denounced the sanctions as part of what he called a campaign of unbridled Russophobia and hinted at countermeasures. The Russian currency, the ruble, as we've heard, has since traded at nearly a two-year low against the dollar.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
A ship that saved 87 migrants in distress off the coast of Libya docked in Spain after roaming the Mediterranean for several days. This is the third such vessel to be allowed into the country in the past 2 months after Italy refused to accept the migrants they were carrying. Reporter Josephine McKenna updates VOA's Kim Lewis on the latest rescue and provides some insight on recent migrant protests in southern Italy.
Spain has accepted 87 migrants who docked in the port of San Roque this morning. They've been aboard a ship that's been roaming around the Mediterranean for days. It's a big issue in the Mediterranean, as we know. Italy has tightened its borders and closed its ports. And this is the third ship that's been accepted by Spain since June, carrying migrants, many of whom have been abused in Libya. Now, this ship is carrying 75 men and 12 boys. They spent 50 hours at sea in an inflatable boat with no drinking water before they were rescued. So they've had a pretty intense ordeal, and it looks like they're going to be finding asylum now in Spain.
What is their condition at this time?
We don't seem to have a full update on their condition, but they have suffered burns and damage from the seawater. They're very dehydrated because they had no drinking water aboard. And incidentally, these migrants have come from Sudan, so they've had quite a journey. They've come through Libya, and there are reports that they've suffered serious abuse as they tried to make their way through Libya. They were rescued by the Spanish NGO Proactiva Open Arms, and this is an NGO that is still continuing to operate in the Mediterranean despite the growing restrictions on NGOs trying to rescue migrants. And what the NGOs are finding now is that Italy and Malta are two countries that are not accepting migrants, and so forcing these NGOs to take them to other locations, and in this case, Spain.
And what is the Spanish government saying about all of this?
Well, the Spanish government is a new socialist government that has only been in power a few months, and it has taken a much more open approach to accepting migrants. It feels a social responsibility. But it's important to emphasize that Spain has not yet suffered the backlash that many other European countries have, like France, Germany, Italy, for accepting migrants. So, if you like, it's a period where the Spanish government can afford to accept migrants and has certainly been adopting a much more open approach. It remains to be seen whether people will have a reaction against that in the near future.
In another migrant story there in Italy, there were protests that occurred after 16 migrants were killed in road accidents returning from work. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, hundreds of migrants, agricultural workers in southern Italy, walked off the job in the fields where they were picking tomatoes around the area of Foggia, a town in the southern region of Puglia, yesterday. They were marching with signs saying, "We are not slaves, no to exploitation." They feel pretty angry, not only about the accidents, but the fact that they are earning up to $50 a day for backbreaking labour in scorching temperatures. They're living in rural ghettos with no electricity, no running water. So the conditions of these shanty towns are really extreme, and they feel like nobody's listening. They're also very upset about the accidents that occurred, the loss of their friends and loved ones. And two of the survivors, one from Senegal and one from the Gambia, also spoke of their shock and upset to have lost their friends in these terrible accidents.
Has there been any reaction to these protests?
There was an outcry across Italy about the accidents themselves, and there's a lot of sympathy for these protests. In fact, the anti-immigration minister, Matteo Salvini, even went down to meet the migrants and spoke about trying to wipe out some of the organised criminal networks that linked to this industry. Now, that's a tall order, but that's certainly a pledge from the government to try and offer greater protection to these migrants.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with Kim Lewis, who hosts the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. This week, African elections, fallout from a narrow and disputed victory for ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, and we preview what's at stake for the runoff election in Mali with J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and John Tomaszewski, Africa director at the International Republican Institute. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. A magnitude 6.2 earthquake rocked Indonesia's Lombok Island and neighboring island of Bali, causing instant panic on Thursday after Sunday's quake in the region killed more than 300. International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is appealing for $9 million to provide emergency aid. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Red Cross teams are still assessing the extent of the damage caused by the magnitude 7 earthquake that struck Indonesia's Lombok Island on Sunday. This earthquake, which followed a smaller one on July 29th, has caused widespread devastation, affecting an estimated 600,000 people. The Red Cross describes the damage in North Lombok as exceptionally destructive, with 75% of the buildings in some villages damaged or turned into rubble. Red Cross Federation spokesman Matthew Cochran says some of the more remote areas of the island are cut off and have not yet been visited. He says it will take many days for the full impact of the disaster to emerge.
One of the interesting things coming in from our teams is the psychological toll of the earthquake. Teams speak of coming across ghost towns of villages that have been essentially abandoned. People have left their homes. They're fearful of living, of staying inside, or perhaps fearful of another major earthquake and a possible tsunami.
Cochran says these emotional scars and the concerns of the remote communities will have to be addressed in addition to providing survivors with emergency shelter and other basic relief. The Red Cross reports some of the thousands of families forced to flee their homes are staying in evacuation centers or in makeshift camps in open areas. The agency says its appeal will provide emergency shelter supplies, as well as materials for repairing and rebuilding damaged houses. Over the coming 18 months, the Red Cross says its emergency operation will focus on creating livelihood opportunities for the survivors. It also will provide health, water and sanitation, protection, and information on disaster risk reduction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
United Nations is reporting that 2.5 billion people worldwide do not have access to adequate sanitation, and more than 760 million are without clean water. One of the organizations dedicated to providing clean water and better sanitation is the U.S.-based development agency East Meets West, which is working to improve these conditions, specifically in Vietnam. I spoke with the group's president, John Anner, about their work and how it got started.
We were founded just about 25 years ago by a woman who was originally from Vietnam, got caught up in the Vietnam War, and then left before the war ended and came to the U.S. She wrote a book about her life. That book was made into a movie. And with this desire to help improve relations between the United States and Vietnam, she launched the East Meets West Foundation.
And what about your work there in the early days?
A lot of what we did was bring Vietnam veterans back to Vietnam so they could get involved in works that were much more constructive and humanitarian in the aftermath of the war. And over the years, we have just grown up in Vietnam, and now for the past 5 years, been expanding outside of Vietnam. So we have four main project areas: clean water and sanitation, education, the third is child health, pediatric health, and the fourth is construction of what we call Vietnam's social infrastructure. So this would be hospitals, libraries, schools, things like that. And so now we work not only in Vietnam, but in 7 or 8 other countries in Asia, and most recently we've launched several programs in India.
You mentioned sanitation as one of your concerns. Having been to Southeast Asia, in fact, a number of Asian countries, I've noticed that sanitation is an issue, especially in rural areas. You've gotten a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Let's talk about what the Gates money will help East Meets West do.
The estimates from the countries themselves are that 50% of the Vietnamese people and 80% of Cambodians simply lack any sort of proper sanitation at home. And without proper sanitation, meaning a sanitary latrine or a toilet or some place to go, there's also very poor hygiene practices. So it's hard to keep your hands clean. It's hard to prevent disease from getting into the food and into the water and so on. So the Gates money is for East Meets West fills a very particular niche, how to deliver large numbers of latrines in a reasonable way, in a way that's cost effective. So an average latrine can cost between $100 and $150. You can do the math. If millions of people need to get those latrines, you're talking about a problem that quickly runs into the tens and then hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, it may be expensive to put these sorts of facilities in place, but I also understand without them, there's even much larger numbers in terms of the economic losses each year to the countries that have these issues, right?
Absolutely. You know, every year we're looking at something like 17,000 deaths in those two countries, and most of those are children. 90% are children under the age of 5. And on top of that, the economic losses from the health issues and the mortality and morbidity that results is approximately $1.2 billion a year. And so we see sanitation as not simply being a health issue, but also something that keeps poor families trapped in that cycle of poverty. It makes it very hard to climb out of poverty when you're constantly suffering the effects of waterborne diseases. It means that people can't work, children can't go to school, the family has to spend a lot of money on treatment, when a few dollars on prevention would just go a long way towards ameliorating that.
John Annan is head of the U.S.-based development agency East Meets West. Still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Leanne Womack. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The back-to-school shopping season is here, and it is big time in the United States.
It's the second biggest shopping season of the year. It's $27 billion are being spent. And so a lot of companies need to double down and really gain those shoppers at this time of the year.
Rod Sides, a retail consultant at Deloitte Services, says kids are eager to buy new specialty items to express themselves and to show who they are. Things like Rocketbook Wave Notebook or the scented markers and creative journals.
There's a novelty factor. If you've got something new, some gadget, etc., it's fun to show your friends.
Angie Miller, a mother, prefers her children use more of the old-fashioned items.
I'd rather have my kid drawing than playing on an iPad or painting or being creative. So that's another reason I don't mind spending the extra money.
Miller plans to spend nearly $500 on back-to-school items for her 3 children, the average for a U.S. household. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
Driving and loving every minute of it, just enjoying the ride.
Diane Womack is an American country music singer and songwriter. When she emerged as a contemporary country artist in 1997, some say her material resembled that of Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette, except for the way Womack's music was a mix of an old-fashioned style with contemporary elements. Finding My Way Back Home easily fits that mold. Diane Womack is married to record producer Frank Liddell, an ex-wife of songwriter and musician Jason Sellers. Her daughter, Aubrey Sellers, is also a country music artist. Her second daughter, Annalise Liddell, was born in 1999. And along the way, she recorded a song singer Martina McBride took to the charts, In My Daughter's Eyes.
In my daughter's eyes, I am a hero. I am strong and wise, and I know no fear. But the truth is plain to see, she was sent to rescue me. I see who I wanna be in my daughter's eyes. Daughter's eyes, everyone is equal. Darkness turns to light, and the world is at peace. This miracle God gave to me gives me strength when I'm weak. I find reason to believe in my daughter.
Womack has released a total of 6 studio albums and 2 compilations. 4 of her albums received a gold certification by the Recording Industry Association of America. Additionally, she's received 5 Academy of Country Music Awards, 6 Country Music Association Awards, and a Grammy Award. Her 2000 single, I Hope You Dance, was a major crossover hit, reaching number 1 on the Billboard Country Chart and the top 15 of the Billboard Hot 100, becoming her signature song.
If you get a chance, you should check this out on YouTube.
her video that goes along with this song. It has her two daughters in it. It's remarkable. Leanne Womack, very, very fine voice. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Yeah, up next is the world news, so you really want to stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Cornelius Wilson, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Leanne Womack. When you come close to selling out, reconsider. Give the heavens above more than just a passing glance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you do.
Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The White House issued a statement strongly condemning the ongoing violence in Nicaragua and human rights abuses committed by the Daniel Ortega regime in response to protests. After years of fraudulent elections and the regime's manipulation of Nicaraguan law, as well as the suppression of civil society, opposition parties, and independent media, the Nicaraguan people have taken to the streets to call for democratic reforms. These demands have been met with indiscriminate violence, with reports of more than 350 dead, thousands injured, and hundreds of citizens labeled coupmongers and terrorists who have been arbitrarily detained, tortured, or who have gone missing. The White House noted that President Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo are ultimately responsible for the actions of the pro-government parapolice, who have brutalized their own people. The United States stands with the people of Nicaragua, including members of the Sandinista Party, who are calling for democratic reforms and an end to the violence. Free, fair, and transparent early elections are the only avenue toward restoring democracy in Nicaragua. The U.S. supports the Catholic Church-led national dialogue process for good faith negotiations toward that end. The U.S. is promoting accountability of Ortega government officials responsible for human rights abuse and corruption. Three Nicaraguan officials, Francisco Diaz, Fidel Moreno, and Francisco Lopez, have been sanctioned under Executive Order 13818, issued by the President of the United States to build upon the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act. These steps, the White House said, are a start, not an end, of potential sanctions in response to continued serious human rights abuses and corruption. The United States is revoking or restricting visas of Nicaraguan officials and their families when those officials have been responsible for police violence against protesters and municipal authorities. The U.S. has also cut off further sales and donations of equipment that Ortega's security forces might misuse. The United States has announced an additional $1.5 million in aid to continue support for freedom and democracy in Nicaragua, providing a critical lifeline for civil society, human rights organizations, and independent media currently under threat from the Ortega regime. The United States called on the Ortega regime to immediately end the state-sanctioned violence perpetrated by police and parapolice forces. The United States will continue to closely monitor the situation in Nicaragua and work with the international community to hold those responsible for the violence to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.